Whether you're just looking to stay warm during a hunt or need maximum concealment, the clothing you wear can make or break a hunt. At MidwayUSA.com, we understand hunting clothing has come a long way with more meticulously crafted camo patterns, advanced scent control technologies, and weatherproof options to withstand the elements. Hunters have to wait until their favorite season, but shouldn't wait on gear, which is why MidwayUSA offers super fast shipping. When you're ready for your next system, log on to MidwayUSA.com. MidwayUSA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high-quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping. MidwayUSA.com.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to the Western Hunting Hub podcast. And just a little quick reminder before we get to our episode today, make sure you go check out what's happening down in Arizona, over in Washington, all these different states that are losing different things. There is a listening period in Arizona right now so that you can actually do something about some of the predator hunting that is getting attacked. So if you need some more information and you can't find it, check out Hunt AZ on Instagram, and Ryan there has got some videos uploaded there to share what struggles they're going with. And even if you don't hunt in Arizona, this is a sportsman's issue, so make sure you pay attention to that, because they'll just move on to your state the next time. Thanks, and enjoy this really, really awesome and fun interview with the Western Huntsman. Enjoy. All right, Jim, thanks for jumping on the Western Hunting Hub podcast, and appreciate you rescheduling with me. We had a little snafu there, and I totally blew it. So, Jim rescheduled. Hey. Appreciate it very, very much, and brought him on. I think I just discovered him on Instagram, and I remember one night just trying to look for some good guests, some people that are doing some things, and I've been digging on your website a little bit, thewesternhuntsman.com, and found a cool thing, a couple of cool things I really like. So let's first get a good introduction and share who you are, your background. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, thanks, Clint. I appreciate you bringing me on, man. It's always, you make it sound like it was such an inconvenience to have to reschedule to talk about hunting, but I mean, that's what I love to do, talk about hunting. So I'm, you know, not worried about it, but Well, kind of like your name suggests, the Western Hunting Hub, you know, we're the Western Huntsman. It's a platform focused on Western hunting, but it's certainly not just limited to Western hunting. For me personally, I grew up hunting the West. I grew up in Utah, and spent a lot of time in Utah, Idaho, and Wyoming, doing very outdoorsy. My family was very outdoorsy. Very much into hunting, very much into fishing, camping, boating, whatever, you name it. And that's kind of how I grew up. And as I grew up, I got this, you know, one of those, we talk about it a lot, that deep-seated childhood passion for hunting and the outdoors and, you know, living it as a lifestyle, more so than just as like a hobby, if that makes sense. And that's what it is for me. It's a lifestyle. We live in two seasons in my family here. We're either gearing up for a hunting season or we're in a hunting season. And there's really no in between. So, I turned 18 and thought it would be a really cool, uniform to wear and join the Marines, thinking I'd pick up chicks with the dress blue uniforms and, did 5 years in the Marine Corps infantry, including, in fact, the week I was supposed to get out of the Marine Corps, the Iraq War started in March of 2003. So I got stuck there and was in that initial drive into Iraq, when it was still more of a conventional thing and less of a, you know, occupational operation, and got out of the Marines, moved back to Utah, had a job offer from a friend of mine up in Spokane, Washington, about a month after I got out. and I liked my prospects up there better than I did in Utah. I was going to miss the Muleys in Utah, but moved up to Spokane, started working for him, and went to college, and I've basically been up here ever since. I took a job back down in Salt Lake back in 2008, and we were there for like 3 or 4 years, and then came back up to North Idaho. Because when I moved up to Spokane, I was only in Spokane for like a month, and then I moved over just across the border. The people that are familiar with the area will know what I'm talking about, to Post Falls, Idaho. And so I was in North Idaho, and essentially we've been in North Idaho ever since. Had a band, country band, that toured around and played in all these rowdy Idaho and Montana bars for a few years.
Awesome.
From what I could remember, it was cool. But honestly, it cut into my hunting time too much, so I stopped doing that. And I got married to my wife Nicole. We have two daughters. They're currently 12 and 10. That's actually about to change, man. It's winter, so I'm going to have a teenager again, and not looking forward to that. But she's a good kid, so whatever. It is what it is. So anyway, last year we sold our house, man. Yeah, we were in Hayden, Idaho. Sold our house. And bought a piece of land, 26 acres up here in Clark Fork, Idaho, and moved out here in a fifth wheel. And we have been basically homesteading out here for the first several months. We didn't have any power, no running water, no nothing. It was a lot of work. Got everything set up. My girls and I, and my wife, we're big time into the outdoors and being sportsmen and. So this was nothing new to them because we camped a lot, but we switched it from camping to actually living in the forest. This is bare land that nobody's ever lived on before. And now I'm happy to say that we have power and running water. As of about 2 weeks ago, we have the running water. Our well finally got finished.
Oh, wow.
So that's made life better. So other than the 4 feet of snow outside, we're doing pretty good with it, man. And we love it. It's not easy, but we love it.
Yeah. That's awesome.
I guess to mix us into all that without boring people to death, a few years back, I was writing articles for some magazines and a hunting blog and some online stuff. And my wife told me that, you know, all you want to do is talk about hunting all the time and what, you know, some of the issues are that we're dealing with as hunters. And why don't you start a podcast? And honestly, I wasn't super familiar with podcasts. I hadn't really been like a big time listener of podcasts before. And so, like a week later, September elk season started. Went out and got an elk down, and it was a decent elk. But when I shot him, he went off this like cliff face up here in North Idaho and busted more than half of his left side off of his antlers, and then took out like a couple of the tines on the other side. It was pretty disappointing, but it gave me a cool studio name, and we call the studio that I record my podcast in the Broken Tine Studio. And so when I found that elk, it was like I was with my cousin Andrew, and I looked at Andrew and I'm like, dude, this is what it's all about. I'm gonna take my wife's advice. I'm starting a podcast. And we started a podcast, the Western Huntsman Podcast, back in 2019, and we have been going about weekly ever since, with the exception of sometimes I shut it down for a few weeks during hunting season. So
yeah,
that's kind of the gist of it, man.
Awesome. And so you've got going on 3 years, just another year or so in front of me on that.
Yeah.
I noticed, and folks out of scroll through some of those episodes. Looks like you've got some great guests on there that I'm excited to go listen to. So want to give us a couple of highlights, and maybe that'd be a little difficult on the number of the episode, but just episodes to look for that were the couple of those good ones, really good ones, or you learned a lot from this guest or whatever. Which ones?
Oh, man, I do have a couple that surprised me. Like like you said, I've gotten some incredible people on the show, and I love my goal, actually, when I started the show, was to just kind of bring awareness to some of the issues that we face as hunters is, and the future of hunting and what we face against the anti-hunting movement and things of that nature, you know, but really more specific to Idaho and kind of this, it was an Idaho specific conversation kind of out the gate. And it turned into, we have, and probably like you guys, but I mean, we get listeners from all over the place, man. It just blew up in a way that I never imagined. Super thankful for that. Way excited about it. But that gave me the ability to bring on some of these big names, and I loved those conversations. But I was real focused on getting people on the show that people had never heard about. And some of the messages that we could get from some of these guests that people would normally not hear from, because everybody's heard the big names on different podcasts and what their message is and what they want to talk about and, you know, hunting styles and all that kind of stuff. But there's a lot of people that are absolute killers in the woods and they deserve to be heard from, but nobody ever hears from them. And so that was kind of my goal. It went like half and half of that. I've got people that are great guests and that people know and I don't know if you want to call them celebrity hunters or whatever. And I've had guests on that nobody knows about, and they are just as effective and good at spreading the information that I think benefits all hunters, whether it's, you know, we're talking hunting strategy or we're talking about the future of hunting or whatever. But to answer your question, I kind of went off on a rant there. I do have a couple of those. And the first one I'm going to tell you, I had a guy named Dan Gardoki on, and I want to say this, I don't remember if it was last spring or the spring before, but it's an episode called Snitches Get Stitches.
I just read that.
And yeah. And the interesting thing with that episode is this guy is like some bird expert, and he's like a nature expert. He is a hunter, but he's not like known as a hunter, right? And he's just somebody, and he's got his friend Nate with him, and Nate is actually how I met Dan. And these two are like nature survivalist type kind of experts that know how to like speak the bird language. And he brought on all this information about like when you're hunting a bear or you're hunting an elk or you're hunting and the bears start talking or I'm sorry, not the bears, the birds start talking and they're starting to make all these different noises and stuff. They're telling you what's going on in front of you and how that can apply to becoming a better hunter. The episode blew my mind and it went like berserk download wise. Everybody loved it. Huh. I was totally surprised by that one. I'd highly recommend everybody get on that one. Another one would be with Dr. Valerius Geist. Dr. Geist is just a legend in wildlife management research and science and all the things when it comes to like wolf management and predator pits and the things that we struggle with sometimes a lot, you know, a lot of these issues, especially in like Wyoming, Montana and Idaho, where we've got wolf issues and different predator problems that we're dealing with. He actually knows what he's talking about, and because he had been studying this, he just passed away this last year.
Yeah.
But he's been in this field and studying the wildlife for so long and written so many books and he has so much credibility on the subject matter that I brought him on for. I could have gone on for like 4 hours with him. And so that was a great one. One of the things that people have really responded well to on our show is we do something called the School of September series.
Yeah, I see that. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so if anybody that's listening to my show knows that I'm super passionate about elk hunting, man. I love archery elk hunting in September and calling in elk and bugles and the whole gamut of what we know of September. It's my biggest passion, and I thought that because I'm not a terrible elk hunter, but I'm not a great elk hunter. For my own selfish reason, if I brought on a bunch of experts to talk just about September archery elk hunting, maybe it would make me better. And so that's what we did. And the School of September, I usually start that around April or May. And once a month, I bring on somebody, whether it's Dirk Durham or Corey Jacobson or, you know, the Elk Shape, Dan Staten, you know, all these yep. names that people know, the Elk Nut, Paul Medill. Everybody that I've brought on has brought like some kind of different type of insight to the episode. That if everybody listens to that, what they're doing, they're able to take some of these tools that these guys are offering and put them in their own toolbox when they go out for elk hunting in September. And it's an education. It's just a lot of really good information and tips and strategies, how to call elk, how to prep for elk season, how to be in shape for elk season, how to, you know, strategize and locate elk, how to break down elk and pack elk out, just everything elk. And so we did that. And that, I would say, those are definitely by far the most popular episodes we do are the School of September episodes. And we're going to do it again this year. We're going to keep rolling. And what I like about it is sometimes I bring the same guests back for like a second round of their School of September episode. And they've got a lot of new insight and information that they can offer. And it just works out. It's just been a great, little series. And I put it all on the website, where if you go to like the articles tab, you can click on the School of September one, and that will have all the episodes in one place. So somebody could just go snatch that and listen to all those episodes. And I promise it'll make you a better elk hunter. It has for me, hands down.
Well, awesome. I'm kind of in a podcast rut right now, and I've got my handful, dropping a couple, picking a couple up here and there. So you got me kind of excited to go listen to a few and
hey, cool, man.
Go listen to some new content. I'm ready to take on another one to binge for a while. So that'll be good to hear. And 'cause I'm excited about, I picked a couple out myself here just with, like you had said, Bonafide Antlers.
Bonafide Antlers.
Yep,
with Ron.
Yep, gonna check out that one. And I had an interview with Kevin from Wilderness Athlete as well. Be interesting to see kind of back then just what he had to say. So a few things there that are pretty pumped for. Go listen to. So awesome. Yeah, go check those episodes out. And then any others that you wanted to highlight, or we can move on.
Yeah, no, I'm obviously, I'm biased. I'm proud of all of them, right? So check them out. if you like to talk hunting, my podcast has an underlying theme of what we're going to do to protect the future of hunting. And the idea is to develop passions in people that might not be passionate about hunting. Maybe they're into it a little bit, and go out for two or three days on a weekend here and there, you know, but maybe they're not passionate enough to pay attention when it's not hunting season, to what some of the threats are to this kind of life. And so there's that underlying theme. You can hear it in the intro, and that is the focus. We want to bring passionate hunters to the table to have these passionate discussions that are important and talk about, our future as hunters and what we're going to do to protect it. So our kids and grandkids can experience it like the same way we did.
Yeah, there's so many people that don't log into their account. They don't see the new handbook until literally the day before. They're missing. They're applying for their tags on the last day. I mean, come on now. That's like, it's foreign to me, because this is what I literally do this hunting stuff for work. I do this in my right now podcasting, and then on the drive home and to work, it's listening to podcasts. So it's nonstop, and my wife loves me for it. But it's just nonstop. And even if that's June, I'm still tuned in to something. And so if you are not tuned in, you made a really good point. You're missing out on a lot of those things that are happening, the legislation, the commission meetings, the things that are changing. Because
that's when the important stuff happens, Clint, I have no problem with somebody that's just a hobbyist hunter. They want to go deer hunting for a few days every year, and that's it. I don't have any particular problem with anybody that wants to do that, because they're still on our team.
Oh, sure.
But what happens is people get so caught up in, you know, after hunting season, then we've got Thanksgiving and Christmas and winter and our jobs and our kids and our, you know, career moves and houses and mortgages and whatever. All these distractions that take away from it, which is just normal life. You can't blame anybody for it. But that is when this negative anti-hunting legislation gets pushed through. That is when bear hunting bans happen in Washington. That is when all these things that kind of come together. It's not like the people that were fighting against these anti-hunting organizations, they're not dumb. They do this when people aren't paying attention. And it is off season and on season. I mean, what better time than when all the elk hunters in the West are in the field hunting elk during, October rifle season or something, to try to push some new piece of legislation through when we're all off grid. So there's never a good time for us and a bad time for them to introduce this. And so that's, I guess, kind of the concept. So a lot of the discussions we have on my show are really centered around that.
And one of those scary new things since COVID started is commission meetings are now broadcasted and anyone can tune in. Anybody can jump in there, and someone from Southern California can jump in and get their 3 minutes or whatever they get and make a complaint. They can bring in that stuff, and to a commission meeting in New Hampshire, they can do that. Jump in there, and now you have somebody that's thousands of miles away influencing the hunters in that state. That kind of scares me.
You're exactly right. And there's another element to that that I think people should know about when it comes to doing these Zoom meeting type commission meetings. There's a human element lost in that kind of meeting, where the importance or the efficacy of the voice of the citizen is really reduced. And what I mean by that is it's the same thing like when you get on Facebook, right, and somebody posts something and somebody else disagrees with it, and they just verbally rip somebody else apart over what they posted, and they're so mean and nasty to each other. Mm-hmm. If they were sitting in a Denny's restaurant having a grand slam breakfast together,
that wouldn't happen.
And they disagreed, that they would not talk to each other like that. If you tried to talk to somebody in the bar like that, man, you'd get punched in the mouth.
Right.
And so this same, that same kind of element transfers, that dynamic transfers to these out of person Zoom online meeting rooms where these commission meetings take place. And it's much more difficult for people to let their voice be heard. And somebody could stand up in a physical in-person meeting. Somebody could stand up and express their opinion and have the passion in their voice matched with the expression on their face and really get their point across. Where when it's online, that we lose all that. And that for since the dawn of time, that is how best communication between humans has happened, is in person. And so, yeah, man, I can go on all night about that.
Oh,
so.
I hated those, the first 2 months of learning to have meetings on Zoom. Oh, I hated it. I went from having a previous job, I went from having the coolest job and loving it to kind of dreading it. There's pieces I dreaded, because having these meetings with my supervisors and totally misinterpreted everything I said, or there's a lag time because my internet was horrible. So it was just, it's like they didn't hear anything I said. It just totally misinterpreted. Oh, it was the worst. That was the worst. I'd never do that again.
Yeah, it sucks. Yeah. It sucks for sure.
So that's a good pivot right into your website and some of these exact things you're talking about. I found on there the 5 principles of the Western Huntsman, and I've had that in the back of my mind. I had a website when I was with Podbean, and I don't have a pod or a website right now for the Western Hunting Hub, just because I'm not a writer. I'm totally audio. I don't have any articles, so I don't sell anything. I don't know. But I've had this in the back of my mind, like what are my principles here with Western Hunting Hub? And I've got them in my head, but I really like yours. Those are perfect. Let's go through some of those. I really, really like them.
Well, thanks, man.
What kind of triggered those things? And talk to us about those different 5 with We Are a Free People is where you're starting.
Yeah, so the first principle is we are a free people. And to answer your question where it triggered it is, I didn't want to just start a podcast without a mission and an objective, right? Mm-hmm. And I had to have something defined that gave me a direction to take the conversations in the show in a way that actually affected change in people's thoughts and behaviors and just, you know, the best way to make an impact is to have a clear direction. And so that's why we put the principles on the website there. And the one that starts off is we are a free people. What that one's really important to me. What I mean by that is we as people, we as Americans, obviously we have listeners all over the world, but are obviously we're based in the United States of America, right? And we believe in the American system to a very deep degree. The freedom to me is not like a buzzword that you hear a lot of these politicians talk about, and they don't even know where to take it. They don't understand the depth as to what this means as an experiment that the world has never seen when you look back through history. And so in my mind, this is an exceptional situation and a standard that no other country has experienced.
Right.
So when I talk about we are a free people, I mean just that. It is not anybody's business or entitlement to be able to dictate the choices and lifestyles of another person. In the United States, if I want to be a hunter, I shouldn't have to explain or defend that lifestyle to an anti-hunter from Portland, Oregon, or San Francisco, California. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a great example of what I mean. I have no problem with somebody that wants to be a vegan. The difference is a lot of vegans like to shove that belief down my throat and try to make me want to be a vegan or force me to be a vegan or something along those lines. And that's where that's inappropriate because it is you're losing the beauty of what the American system is, the live and let live system that has created the highest level of comfort for humans on the face of the planet. We are a free people. We make our own choices. Our destiny is ours to create. I will never tell somebody how to live their life as long as they don't tell me how to live my life. And that, to me, is a critical step when we're talking about everything, you know, hunting context-wise, moving forward. So that's why it's number one, because first of all, we are a free people. We won't let anti-hunters or anybody else tell us that we can't do this. This is a right. This is a life that we choose. And we don't want anybody to tell us that we're wrong or we can't do it anymore. Just like we won't tell anybody else that they're wrong for living the kind of life that they want to lead. So long as they're not running around wanting to be rapists and murderers and child molesters, right? We've got to use some common sense there. So that's principle number one.
Well, and let me comment on one thing there. It's just so idiotic for somebody to try and force a veganism approach on someone. It doesn't even make sense. It doesn't work. You can't have everybody in the world be a vegan. It doesn't work. You don't have enough ground for growing whatever plant. And I loved, I'm, I don't watch a lot of TV, but my wife and I really, really enjoy Yellowstone. It's just a good show.
And you know why I'm mad at that show, man?
Oh, why?
I'll tell you why I'm mad. Because I love that show too. But you know, they had this scene where John Dutton, the main guy, Kevin Costner, he's got a bottle of Bullet whiskey on his nightstand or whatever, wherever he had that. And he pours some, whatever. And, That's my whiskey of choice, man.
And you can't find it now, huh?
And now I can't find it. Everybody goes out and bought it, man. It drives me crazy.
There's a quote that he had on one of the most recent episodes, and I'm still two behind, so let's just not break any ruin anything for anybody.
Okay, I won't ruin it, man, because I'm all caught up.
Yeah. But he says, "You ever plow a field?" Because he's talking to the vegans that were. Or the protesters, to plant the quinoa or sorghum or whatever the hell it is you eat, you kill everything on the ground and under it. You kill every snake, every frog, every mouse, every vole, every mole, worm, quail. You kill them all. So I guess the real question is, how cute does an animal have to be before you care if it dies to feed you?
And he's exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like,
do you know, that's actually a Ted Nugent quote.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. Yeah. That's where that quote came from, was Ted Nugent. And, I don't know if it's exactly word for word, but it's really, really close. Well, and if you break that down, he's exactly right. Just like what you said, there's not enough room in the world for all of us to be vegans. There's not enough room in the world or wildlife for everybody to be a hunter. So why not, if you choose to be a vegan, live that lifestyle? In my opinion, I have no problem with you doing it. I think being a vegan is unhealthy. I think it's, if you're doing it for the social construct or the reasons that are making you think you're getting on some kind of moral pedestal or high ground, you're wrong. Because the facts don't support that. But if you want to, if you truly just want to be a vegan, I don't have any problem with that. I don't have any problem with anybody's lifestyle.
Yeah.
It just transfers to what he said. And it transfers to, I'm a free American. Don't tell me I can't go hunting because you think there's something wrong with it because you don't understand the history of mankind and where hunting came from and what it has done for the betterment of human and the human condition throughout world history.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you said that. So I'm not, discrediting Mr. Ted Nugent. That'd be a shame to let popular culture and someone who really, Kevin Costner does not fit his role there as anti-gun or whatever he is. I don't know. I don't really pay attention.
I don't either.
But
I don't.
That's my wife.
We can have a whole podcast on Hollywood hypocrisies, buddy.
Oh yeah, sure, for sure. I'm not the one to host that one. I don't have a clue. Okay, so moving on.
The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com. Knives, machetes, saws, and shears, multi-tools, shovels, swords, axes, spears, hatchets, and tomahawks. If it cuts, snips, slices, or chops, Midway USA has it. Find great gift ideas in our huge selection of pocket knives and other everyday carry folding knives. Make a statement or create a family legacy with one of our top-of-the-line hunting knives. We've got a great selection of manual and electric sharpeners, too. For just about everything for the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
Next one we got.
Public land is forever. Yeah. Public land is what a lot of people confuse, and this is where things get fuzzy. When you're talking about public land, things get really fuzzy because of politics, right? You know, politics likes to muddy the water anyway. And where some of that kind of gets muddy, I guess, I don't know how I'm trying to explain that, but you know, you've got people on the right that don't believe in public land, that the state should own all the land. But what they don't understand about that is when the state owns it, most states have either constitutional mandates or some kind of requirement that like I'll give you a great example here in the state of Idaho. State-owned land has a constitutional mandate that states that if the state owns land, it has to generate revenue to benefit things such as public school districts. And there's other things that it would benefit. There's nothing wrong with that. However, public land owned by the United States Forest Service managed by the United States Forest Service or managed by BLM, public land is ours. We own the land. It does not have to generate revenue. It does not have to serve any specific purpose outside of public access. And when somebody is in like Texas for example, or like when I was stationed in the Marines out in North Carolina, public land was super limited. I mean, there just really wasn't a ton of public land. It was all privately owned, and there was nowhere for just somebody that was making a military kind of salary to go hunt. And it was a problem. Like we got screwed. And so here in the West, we don't have that problem. We have like one example. I live in the Clark Fork Valley, which separates two of the biggest national forests in the United States. I can go north and be in some of the most remote, high timber, coniferous forest kind of high country that you can ever imagine. Or I can go south and be in the same stuff, but I don't know what the difference is, but minus the grizzly bears, go south. So guess which way I usually go?
Away from the bears.
Yeah, I don't like the grizzly bears, man, because yeah. I hunt alone a lot. But anyways, so public land is important, and it's it should never be sold to or transferred to the state. And the lies that these politicians tell, talking about how, oh, well, we need to give this U.S. Forest Service land, we need to transfer that back to the state. When they say that, they're lying or they're incompetent, because it never was the state's to begin with. This is federally protected land for you and I to enjoy. And it's where it's if that land is transferred and the state takes ownership, they will sell it to private owners. Mainly, you know, in Idaho, we have a big problem with Texas billionaires, the Wilkes brothers. Oh, I didn't mean to say their name out loud. They like to buy the public land and block it off to everybody so nobody has access to it. Yeah. That's just not a, you know, just, I guess going back, it is a pillar. It is a principle of the Western Huntsman that public land is forever. It's ours and don't mess with it.
I also, like that you got the North American model of wildlife conservation in there. I bet if you pull 1,000 hunters, I would bet that 95% of them could not state a single one of those principles of those seven principles. I think
the seven sisters. Yeah,
I think it's so underrepresented. The representation of it is what I'm trying to say. It's not out there as for hunters to just see and to connect with as much. And when I'm always teaching Hunt Safe hunter education programs, it's like you need to know that part. That part's so important. So important. You don't have a
so important
that is why we are looking at science related pieces instead of emotional related pieces when talking about a bobcat trapping ban or bear hunting bans or whatever it is. Yes, the state agencies definitely have to manage a social aspect. Totally understand. That is a piece of what they do, and they have to, but it is in our DNA of all these agencies to manage wildlife based on sound science principles, as well as these other items here, so that we don't turn into Europe. There's a population that wants to turn into Europe for some unknown reason.
I know, right?
But when the wildlife do not belong to you, that's a bummer. And if it's a status thing to not be able to go do that, on top of the gun and the bow issues and not being able to have certain things. I got a buddy who just got back. Nope. He's got two more days in Spain, I believe, hunting ibex. And I'm going to get him on. We're going to talk about that a little bit.
You should. Yeah, that'd be cool.
I'm excited. He actually was quite impressed with how they manage wildlife. Some really interesting things. So I'm excited to hear his feedback on that. I know probably Spain does that a touch different than say the UK and who rules the wildlife. But I know there's some really great places to hunt for sure, and they do it a certain way. But it's not.
But for the most part, it's about the average hunter. I had a guy on my show from the UK. That episode is called "From Across the Pond" with Kenneth Bartlett. And Kenneth talked about, you know, he is a super passionate bow hunter. Do you know how many times he's been actual bow hunting? Never.
Huh.
He has never been bow hunting, but he has a bow and he has a great, he's all outfitted. He's got a great pack. He's got all this stuff. He'd love to go bow hunting, but he's an average individual in a country that you have to have the king's permission to hunt his deer. You know, essentially, I know there's not like, you
yeah,
know,
yeah, yeah,
whatever, but I'm not like a UK scientist here, but you know what I mean? We don't ask the king's permission to hunt his deer. In America, the wildlife is held in the public trust, and that's what the Seven Sisters talk about in the North American model of conservation. What that means is a great way to break that down is one of my daughters was like, "Well, Dad, since we own the land, why can't we just shoot a deer whenever we want?" And what I had to explain to her, because again, we're on this 26-acre homestead. We've got, we've got some huge bucks on this property.
That's awesome.
And they're a lot smarter than me. And I'm a public land hunter through and through, but I didn't realize what I was getting into. I don't even know what to do with it. All these big bucks run through. I'm like, oh shit. Yeah, they're well, okay. Anyways, but that's what she said. She says, you know, why can't we just shoot them if they're on our land? Well, and I explained to her because honey, we don't own them. We don't own the wildlife. They're not ours to shoot. They're managed for the greater good. They're not managed for just us because we own this chunk of land. They're managed for everybody. And that is why our system works so well. That's why we have had such an increase in white-tailed deer in this country, and turkeys and Rocky Mountain elk and all these species that are thriving because of the efforts of hunters that are all using this North American model of wildlife conservation. And so I think when I put it into that perspective, it helped her understand, and I hope it helps other people understand, that there is something to this wildlife model of conservation that we use here. If you look throughout the world, there is nobody in the world that can come out of high school at maybe, you know, 19 years old where, and I'm using that age bracket for a reason. We're all broke at 19, right? None of us have, we don't even know how we're going to fill up our truck next week with gas, but we could still get a tag and we have opportunity to go out and hunt a deer. That only happens in the United States and in Canada because of the North American wildlife conservation, model of conservation. And so anyway, sorry, I get passionate about this stuff. You could tell.
No. And if you're listening, you don't really have a clue what that is. And even if you don't like to read, it's like a one pager from the Fish and Wildlife Service. Yeah. There, it looks like you got a link from RMEF.
I put the link on RMEF because I'm a RMEF fan, so I'm hoping it'll help direct people to RMEF.
Yeah, and I bet it's a one pager, pretty short little. There's not a lot there. It doesn't take long to read through. So
everybody should read that for sure.
Yeah,
it's absolutely 5 minutes.
All right, to hold in trust.
So that kind of goes back to the model in a lot of ways, to hold in trust. And I say it right there, what I just said, we will never ask to hunt the king's deer. Mm-hmm. The animals are ours as a collective society. They're not specific to the Humane Society of the United States or the Center for Biological Diversity or PETA. They're theirs. They're ours. They're the bird watchers. They're the wildlife managers. They are the wildlife biologists. They are the attorneys in downtown Austin, Texas. They are the garbage man in Cleveland, Ohio. Everybody gets to enjoy the wildlife in the same way, as long as it is legal and being managed through science, that we enjoy these animals. We can hunt them. We can get a tag. We don't have to have $200,000 to buy a deer tag. Our deer tags well, obviously I'm talking about resident hunters. When you go non-resident, you're going to pay a little bit more.
Right.
But I mean, everybody can get a deer tag and go deer hunting. And we don't have to worry about having to get, you know, a second mortgage to get a hunting permit or worrying about PETA telling us we can't, right?
Yeah.
That is the idea of that. And the other factor, again, that to hold in trust really is a summarization of the Seven Sisters of the North American model of wildlife conservation, where we don't commercialize wild game meat. We don't go out and shoot a bunch of elk and sell it to a restaurant that wants to sell elk stroganoff, right? Because that is what happens in other countries. And that's why many countries, the game species are so limited and so far and few between, because it's a commercialized system. We don't have that here in America. We can all enjoy it. It's affordable for everybody. And we can easily get a tag. We can easily afford it. We can easily find the wild game that we are looking for. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I always find it baffling when people try and like say, oh, I'll pay you for some of that meat. No, that doesn't. No, that doesn't. No. And then we dive into the conversation.
Are you trying to get me to go to jail?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, no. You don't know how big a deal that one would be. No, I'm giving you this, and it's what I like to do. Just take it, and I don't want anything in return, because that's not kosher. So and that's, some people always struggle with that a little bit of like, you're giving them something and you're not giving anything in return or paying. But we, like you said, we all can't be hunters, and
we all can't be hunters. And there's a lot of like personal fulfillment and enjoyment when you take the wild game that you harvested and give it to somebody who doesn't have any.
Absolutely.
It's healthy to the soul. Try it out.
Yeah. No, I get my reward because of that. That's what I get in return.
Yep.
And I like that. If you think about native populations, not everybody was hunters. Not everybody went out and hunted. And any tribesmen around the world, there were people that stayed back. There were people around. I'm a hunter. That's what I do. And I go out and I collect that, and let me share that with you.
You're exactly right.
Yeah. So that, and I love that. I had way too many tags, and some people asked me that this year. It's like, how would you ever eat all of that? Like, I don't. I share it with people that really enjoy it. They get excited about it. I gave a buddy 2 whole deer the other day, and I went out and hunted them just for him. I knew he wanted a couple of deer. And you know those people that really want it. My brothers, they don't hunt a whole lot anymore or at all. So sending meat home with them over Christmas was great. And I know they'll eat it. And I know my brothers, they love to use their Traegers, and they're gonna do some fun stuff with it, and they're gonna like it and enjoy it. So I know it's not,
think of you in a positive way every time they cook it.
Yeah, it's not my brothers.
No. Maybe not your brothers.
Yeah, maybe not my brothers. No,
I knew we'd get along, man.
No, yeah, no, they're always appreciative. They send me pictures or say that what they made out of it of some sort. So, and my nephew, over Christmas, he requested elk tongue. That was his one thing.
I mean, really?
We've got a prime rib there, and he doesn't want it. Yeah, I usually did a little wild game feed over Christmas for my family. It's like, okay, what's some new recipes, some crazy things, some whatever, some beaver tail, tongue, and then some ribs and meatballs and just fun stuff that just gets you thinking about how to do some different culinary things. It makes it fun.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that.
And this year it didn't happen because I wasn't getting in the middle of the planning of meals this year. And I wasn't. I don't need to say anymore. But I wasn't getting in the middle of that. So, and that's when my brother said, no, Reese is really, really excited about having some elk tongue. It's like, well, good thing I got a couple in the freezer. I'll make him some elk tongue.
That'd be a first for me. I've never had elk tongue.
It's a texture thing, and there's some things you got to do with it. You really got to do some things with it.
Okay. I'll call you up and ask you about it when the time comes.
It's not honestly my favorite. I've had some things that are really good. First time I had it, I thought it was amazing, and then as leftovers the next time, nope, no good. Yeah, a gentleman that was my landlord, actually, he said, oh, bring me a tongue, I'll make you this, because his family was Amish, and he just made me, I think he just boiled it and sliced it and put it on a sandwich, and I was like, this is so good, and then pulled it out the next time, I was like, I couldn't eat it. I don't know, it was weird.
Oh, wow. Yeah, but that'd be a little weird, though.
It's like eating heart. Got a different texture. It's just different. You can get a little bit of that, even more of that mental aspect to it, that this is a tongue. There's not taste buds in there anymore, but it's different. It's really fatty. Just a different kind of thing.
For sure.
So, number four, respect to each outdoorsman. I like these last two a lot.
I really like number four. And this has been a huge subject and talking point on my show lately. As it says on the website, we are not a purist platform. And what that means is I'm not just like a traditional bow hunter, right? I'm not just a fly fisherman. I do all of it personally. And I don't care if somebody is a purist when it comes to that. And everybody kind of defines the purist aspect in their own way. But the point is as hunters and as outdoorsmen, we have to understand that whether you're a bow hunter, a rifle hunter, a traditional archery hunter, a muzzleloader hunter, a bait fisherman, a trapper, a houndsman, whatever you do, I don't care if you hunt elk on a high fence ranch and you pay $200,000 to go do it. But at the end of the day, our goal is the same. We want the meat in the freezer, and most of us like to go for the most mature animal we can find. That doesn't mean we're trophy hunters, right? But we do like a big, nice set of antlers. I mean, who doesn't? Let's just be adults about it. We all like that. If two bucks walked out and one was a little forked horn and one was a 200-inch mule deer, there's no doubt in my mind that anybody listening to this, which one they would shoot, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that doesn't make anybody a trophy hunter. I'm not a trophy hunter, but I do like to go after some mature deer, especially deer. I'm not a good enough hunter at anything else to, you know, go too crazy. But the point is, we respect and enjoy each other, and we understand that we're all on the same team. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter how you pursue the game, the wild game. I don't care if you use a guide or you hunt private land or you're a public land guy. I don't care. At the end of the day, we all have the same goal. We all have the same passion. And the most important part of that is we all have the same enemy out there. And the enemy are the anti-hunting folks that want to shut our lifestyle down because they don't understand the science behind the management of game species through hunting. And so this is where social media has become a problem. Everybody has a problem with the way somebody else is doing it. You wouldn't believe the threads. Well, you probably would see the threads I've seen of people arguing about how to skin a deer or what caliber is the best caliber for an elk or how to bait a bear or how to do this and how to do that. What boots to wear? What's the best pack? And these hunters go at each other's throats over these issues that are totally irrelevant. Meanwhile, you've got PETA and the Center for Biological Diversity sitting back, soaking this up and eating this stuff up and utilizing it against us. And that is the point to the number four. We've got to love each other. We've got to respect each other. We've got to understand, like, I'm a big-time fly fisherman, but you think I won't go drown a worm to catch a bass? Hell no. I'll do that all day long. I'll have a ball doing it. I love fly fishing because of the areas it puts me in and the rivers that I get a stand on to do it. But I am not above taking a worm and opening up a beer and dropping that worm into the water and catching a trout. It doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
And we all have to understand whether you are a purist in one way or another, because I understand I've got some friends that are traditional archery hunters and they're stone cold traditionalists. They don't want any kind of technology. They want their stick bow. They want their spot that they're hunting, and that's all. They don't want any of, you know, whatever else might be, you know, like for my bow, I've got the best sights on it. I use a release, and I've got these arrows that my buddy knows how to make them, how he makes them for me, and they're perfect and all that kind of stuff. But my buddy, Nate, who is a traditionalist, me and him, we don't fight about it. He likes to hear my stories, and I love to hear his stories. He's been on the show a few times. In fact, he shot his biggest bear ever this year with a traditional bow.
Wow.
And that is the essence of what we do. We must respect it because not everybody's into it. And one great example of that, what I was talking about, when you're talking about bow hunting, some people are just bow enthusiasts, right? They want to go shoot targets all the time. They want to go to the 3D archery hunts or shoots. There is nothing wrong with that. For me, I'm not like an archery enthusiast. I'm a bow hunter. I shoot my bow to a point to which I know that I'm going to be very lethal with it when it comes to hunting season. But I'm not like a very technical enthusiast when it comes to bow hunting. Same thing with rifles. Rifles are a tool for me. I'm not like an enthusiast shooter. I don't go just shooting for the sake of shooting. I go shooting to sight in my rifle and make sure I can still hit things. And I'm pretty deadly with it, so I'm not worried about it.
Nope.
We have to understand that all of us are in this game, and that's the beauty of hunting and being a sportsman is the incredible amount of intricacies that we can get into. There's so many layers to it, and not everybody is going to follow the same layering system. We have so many different ways to approach hunting and so many different ways to enjoy it. And what we get out of it is fulfilling our souls as hunters in a way that people that never do it will never understand. And so we've got to respect each other and quit fighting on freaking Facebook all the time over what caliber somebody's shooting. Like, have you ever seen an argument so ridiculous as the pro 6.5 Creedmoor versus the anti 6.5 Creedmoor? Like, what the hell?
It's just laughable.
It is laughable, but it's also concerning.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. For certain topics, absolutely, because you have certain antis watching. You have people watching.
Yeah.
And for those very good opportunities to nab a picture, nab a comment, nab it, and they got a data point.
Yeah.
And I definitely think about, too, the people that are on the East Coast or on the eastern side of the U.S. that are doing deer drives, and how some people in the West here be like, no, you shouldn't be doing that, while we're out here chasing lions with dogs. And out there they may be like, no, you shouldn't be doing that. Just like what you're saying. We're on the same team. We have different cultures throughout. I've spoken about this a couple of times on this podcast, but there's different hunting cultures, but it's still, we are all hunters.
Exactly.
And those people that have found arrowheads those people that find those arrowheads think about that little connection that they had with that hunter that was thousands of years ago.
Oh, man.
Picking up something or seeing that. We have that connection there with that individual, and yet we can't have a connection with a lion hunter or a deer drive guy.
So true. I love that. I love that comparison you made. I was bow hunting at like 10,000 feet elevation in central Utah for mule deer one time. And I had just bought, I had saved money. This was back before I had, I was broke. Let's put it that way. I was broke. And I had saved money for months to buy this new bow. It was a PSE Stinger or something like that. I was super excited. I go up 10,000 feet elevation. This is that time I was telling you that my wife and I, we moved back to Utah because I had taken a job down in Salt Lake, down there and we spent like, I don't know, 3 or 4 years there, had it with Utah and came back to Idaho because we love Idaho. But I'm up there hunting and I came across this Spree Rock area and I found the coolest original arrowhead that was laying under this sagebrush under some dirt. And I was actually sitting down to kind of do some glassing and whatnot. And I was just kind of moving the dirt around. This arrowhead pops up. This thing had to be 1,000 years old. And think about that for a minute. Like, think about that.
You were thinking
what's that?
I was just thinking you were sitting in the same spot someone else sat in because you had the same idea about that spot.
We had the same view. We knew, okay, if I could see what I'm going after across this little canyon, I can make a game plan as to how I can get there. And somebody, I actually had it historically referenced when this happened, but this was 10 years ago, and I can't remember. It was somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 years ago. Hmm. And I just can't remember exactly. Hmm. But
I still have
it's
not.
It's just an amazing thing. It's just an amazing thing. Somebody 1,000 years ago was sitting on that mountain thinking that they were going to take a bow and kill an animal for sustenance and life and fulfillment. And I'm sitting here 1,000 years later doing the same thing with modern equipment, but right. still with a bow.
Yeah.
Just, it's crazy.
I still have not found any cool artifacts like that, but I'm trying to look at the ground a little bit more because I really want to find something. Because it's a good opportunity here in South Dakota to find stuff like that.
I was going to say, you're in South Dakota, man. You should be. You might. Yeah. You should be in good area for that.
Yeah. But sure. I did find one year trapping. I looked at a piece of ground. I was like, ooh, I like that spot. I'm going to go put a trap there. And I went over to put my trap right in that area. And I pulled up an old double long spring that some old trapper had left there. And I was like,
no kidding.
I was like, yes, I had the same idea that old timer did. This is a good spot.
That's awesome. That's so cool.
Yeah.
So cool.
And that was something that happened probably 30 years prior. And it was not that old of a trapper. It probably was the previous landowner. The trap was probably, I know, it was double long spring. I got into trap collecting a little bit here and there, but it was one that was probably in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Probably somewhere in there.
So amazing.
But
I mean, I love that kind of stuff, man. That is so cool.
Yeah. So yeah. Respect to each outdoorsman. I like it.
Yep.
Poachers are not hunters. That's such the headlines get that wrong all the time.
Yeah. Well, you said it, the headlines. In fact, just recently there was, I read a headline that made me cringe. It was like, you know, two hunters arrested for poaching an elk. Well, is that how you say that headline? Or do you say two poachers arrested for poaching an elk? Because they're not hunters. They may have at one point in their life been hunters, but they're not hunters anymore. Hunting, in order for it to work and in order for the balance of wildlife management to succeed on the landscape, it has to be done through science and legally. If it's not, then what you're doing is you're going against the wildlife management system. And so you're throwing the landscape and the ecological system, the wildlife management process out of balance. And just, you know, it's unsportsmanlike anyway.
Yeah.
But
when you're,
hunters are not poachers. Poachers are not hunters. It's a very simple concept.
When you're playing,
we don't tolerate it here.
You didn't say anything about, do you have brothers?
Yeah, I've got a little brother. Yeah.
All right. When you guys were playing Monopoly or some board game, and my older brother, I don't know. I know he cheated. I got a picture of him looking at my cards when we were young kids. That's why I never won. Yeah, that's why I never won. that was not a. He did not win after that.
Yeah,
he cheated.
Yeah,
he didn't win. It was not the exact same thing. Not the same thing at all.
It is not. It is not the same thing. And you know, it's one of those things. You know, a lot of my thought process with that particular principle on the website there, the poachers are not hunters, is it's really kind of geared towards thinking about our next generation and the future of hunting and teaching the kids what is hunting ethics. Because I feel like we had some time that went by where the adults were not maybe teaching the ethical side of hunting, and that's why many of us end up with experiences with a bunch of jerks on the mountain. I don't want to cuss.
Right.
I don't know what your policy on cussing is, but there is a lack of ethics and responsible hunting and sportsmanship that I've noticed in the last 15 years or so. I don't know how old you are. I just turned 41. I'm not super happy about being in my 40s, but it is what it is. Here we go.
35. Got a few
okay,
more years.
Okay, so there. You're just right behind me, man. Yeah. Like, you're going to be 40 before you. Enjoy 35 to 40 because it happens fast. anyways, you know, it's just an interesting thing. When I was a when I was a kid, and you know, the whole blaze orange thing was kind of a new thing. Everybody was having to wear blaze orange when we're deer hunting. If you saw blaze orange on a mountain, you moved on. We went elsewhere. And I know that there's a lot of areas where that's going to be very difficult because of the amount of hunters that we have.
Right.
But I can also tell you that if you look hard enough, you'll find those. You'll find the areas where you can get away from it. But nowadays, man, it's like everybody's just up in your face all over the place. And they don't care if they're ruining your hunt or they're stepping on your toes. It's all public land, and the animals are owned by everybody. So it's not like there's anything you could do about it. But there used to be a much higher level of respect where if somebody was parked at a smaller trailhead where, you know, you knew if one or two hunters was in there, that kind of took that whole area up. Where now, people don't care. You'll have 10 trucks parked there, and all of a sudden you've got a bunch of people in there.
Do you think that has any connection to new hunters that were not raised in hunting families going out and they're just maybe ignorant to the fact?
That could totally be, man. I've never really thought about it that deeply, but that could totally be. Yeah, it's just a piece, man. When I was a kid, if there was a truck parked somewhere, whether it was my dad or my grandpa or whatever, it was like, okay, well, that's okay. Well, this is why we have plan A to Z, not just plan A. And we'll go to plan B. And you just keep going. And that's okay.
Because what do most of those people that don't get into hunting until, let's say, their 30s, but they also enjoy the outdoors? They'd go to a trailhead, they'd see other vehicles, and they'd continue mm-hmm. hiking. So it's
a great point.
That's not a foreign thing to them if they didn't have somebody, a mentor like you, saying something like, hey, no, let's move on. So there's so many different things to learn. Too many different things to learn. And I going back to your last respect each outdoorsman, I made a note here. I had a question from someone the other day. They had shot a fawn, a young of the year. It was an antlerless tag, and little white tails sometimes get really tricky to know. You know, is that thing 6-8 months year old, or is that a year and a half year old? For a new hunter for sure. So, but it was a little button buck, and they didn't know it. And had they known it, they probably wouldn't have shot it. But she asked me about, well, how could I tell it was with another buck? Is that kind of a normal thing? Would they be moving around here and with them? And I know a lot of people that would just jump in with a, this is what happens, here's my opinion, blah, blah, blah. And I just always go to, well, it depends. It just so depends. There's, I really try not to be an opinionated hunter that says that I know the answer. I know the answer. This happens all the time. And that seems to be the case. Like the 6.5 is the best. The whatever is the best. And well, it depends. there's a lot of depends to the situation. And there's always scenarios where can happen this way this time. It's going to happen that way another time. So,
oh, you're exactly right. I mean, shoot, man, a little button buck could have been with a doe just as easily as it was with a buck. I don't know.
Absolutely.
And I do get opinionated, but there's, when you're talking about like the behavioral aspect of wildlife and deer and elk and gosh, man, I know that there is like a general set of ideas that make sense to people. But I can't tell you how many times I've seen wildlife buck the general belief.
right. And that's, you know what I mean? And that's the thing I was trying to, not necessarily opinionated. That's not literally the word, but what you just said, that's what I was trying to portray, that yes, the mold is broken quite a bit.
Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, that always changes the perception of, and I always tell people, it's like that makes hunting fun. I mean, you go out and you see something new every time. You wonder why that deer was able to, why you were able to get so close, but yet you peek over to the next ridge and that deer bolted.
Yeah, exactly. That always
throws me off.
Exactly.
That's why I say, always have your bow ready. Always have it with you. Cause I didn't fill my archery deer tag in South Dakota this year just cause I didn't shot and got a little, my shooting got a little rough at the end of the year. the daylight, lack of daylight really hurt me on my practice time. But yeah, I just had one moment in particular, carrying my checking trail cameras and not carrying my bow during the season. And there's a buck standing at 30 yards as I go to check my camera. I was like, oh, well, I guess I should have been carrying my camera as I'm just walking loudly through the woods.
And you just never know, man. Yeah. You just never know. I've talked about it on my show. I missed out on a drop time north of 300 inch bull elk this year because my bow, the string when I drew back, got caught in the camera that was strapped to my shoulder. I had this shoulder, the pack shoulder mounted Tacticam camera for a point of view filming.
Yeah.
And I was trying to get it on film, and this bull, dude, he just came in like so much faster than I've ever seen a bull. You know, most bulls are, they get hung up. They're a little leery. They're a little more cautious. Not this guy, man. He was looking for a fight, and I bugled, and he was on top of me within 30 seconds. And when I was ready for him, but what I wasn't ready for is all the alder brush had pushed that camera down. So when I drew back, my string got caught, and I have it all on film. Oh. So that nobody can be like, oh, you're just full of crap. Nope, I got it on film right here. And you can see it drops my camera down, and you can see my foot, and you can hear me cussing.
Oh,
this drop time bull is standing there looking at me like, what is that? And like, turns around and runs off.
Where was the drop time coming out of?
Like, on his left side. On his left side, just it was like this weird ball on the bottom. Past his ear, and it was the craziest thing, because when he came off the nub, he was laid up with a bunch of cows on top of this hill. I almost said the name of that hill, but people would know where I'm talking about in North Idaho. It's my secret spot. It's my, nobody ever hunts it for elk. Everybody goes there for, like, you know, white-tailed deer and stuff.
Yeah.
But nobody goes there for elk season. So in September, I have this whole mountain to myself, and if you hike all the way to the top of it, there's always a herd of elk up there. And there's always two or three bulls up there. And I've had a lot of success up there. Anyways, I knew that they were up there because I bugled at him, you know, almost a mile before this. And he answered back. And so what I did is I just shut up and got right up in his business and got within about 50 yards or so from where they were bedded down. And I ripped off this huge, nasty, mean bugle, telling him where he can go stick it. And he jumps out of his bed and was on top of me within 30 seconds. And the point is when he came up over the top of the hill, because he was bedded on the other side, there was like this bare patch of trees. And he comes running through, and it's probably 50, 60 yards from me. And I could see the drop time at that point. That's how, like, obvious it was.
Oh, wow.
Then he runs down through these alders, and I had been kind of traipsing through the alders, and that's what kind of knocked my camera down. Anyway, I have some heartburn over that particular day, obviously.
Yeah.
So it was awesome though. Awesome experience.
Yeah.
It just goes to show, you just never know. You just never know. Sometimes if you're traipsing, like you were saying, walking through the woods without a care in the world, and there's a huge buck standing there. Sometimes you let a bugle off and the bull's on top of you in 30 seconds. They don't need any more coaxing. You know, it just depends.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love it.
Well, I told you I wouldn't start any more big topics. We're at an hour and 10. So, glad we got one little quick hunting story in there. I'm really glad we did, but I really like the, review of your five principles. I think there's plenty there for everybody to hear and get refreshed on and learn from again. And a thing to go look for, like the North American model. So go digging for that, but I'll get you. Sure. Get you moving. You're on a different time zone than me, so you're at 9:01 right now. So I'll let you get off to whatever you got to do to end your evening.
No, I'm on 7. I'm on Pacific time in North Idaho. I'm only at 7 o'clock.
Oh, 7. Oh, whoops. Yeah.
I think you're on 9.
It's 8 here.
I'm on, it's 8.
Yep,
okay.
Yep.
I'm on mountain.
Yep.
Gotcha.
Yeah. God, the time zones are the hardest thing for recording podcasts.
I know, man. I always screw them up. So, no, I appreciate you having me on, Clint. This is it was a fun conversation. Thanks a bunch. I'll have to get you on my show one of these days.
Yeah, you bet. I'd love to chat and whatever. Whatever comes up, we can discuss and.
That's the best point. That's best. Yeah. Best part of doing a podcast, man, is all the new friends we get to make.
Absolutely. That's why I'm doing it. So
for sure.
All right. Well, have a good evening and stay in touch.
You as well. Thanks, right. Clint. We'll talk to you soon.
See ya. Have a good night.
All right. You too. Got a deed to the land, but it ain't my ground. This is God's
country. A life that has the stories to back it. A life to be proud of. It's a Winchester life.
Yeah, baby. 6'8 Western. Oh, mule there, baby. Right there.
Tune in every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.